the mixtape with Scott. I'm the host, Scott Cunningham. I'm a professor of economics at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. The podcast, The Mixtape with Scott, is about two things. One, it's about listening to the personal stories of living economists. And number two, it's an oral history of the last 50 years of the profession. The latter part, the oral history part, tends to work in stories, meta stories. These are the meta stories of the profession. This might be things like, the students of Gary Becker, as Becker was at Columbia and as Becker was at Chicago. Or it might be the story of economists going into the tech industry, starting with people like, Varian and Susan Athey, and then kind of going forward. But it's also the story of causal inference, specifically, not just econometrics, but causal inference specifically. It's probably the one topic that I am obsessed with. And I wish I don't know. I don't know if I wish I wasn't, but I've got this itch and I can't scratch it. Well, today's guest for me kind of fits a bunch of things. Bruce Sacerdote, he gives his really long title on the show, and I'm not going to say it because it was like a bunch of words, but he's a professor at Dartmouth College. He's been there ever since he graduated back in, I believe, like 97, 98 or something like that, I think. Bruce did his PhD at Harvard University from 92 to 97. And those of you that know, 92 to 97 is kind of a critical part in the history of causal inference because Josh Angrist gets there in 89. He overlaps with Hedo Imbens, 1990. The late paper ends up getting written, published in Econometrica, 94. Another paper co-authored with Don Rubin, who's in the stats department, obviously a giant in the history of causal inference, gets published in 96. So he's right there in the middle of it. But it's not just that. When I interviewed Dejia, when I interviewed Rahib Dejia, who had co-authored several papers with Waba on the propensity score, that had revisited that old Bob Lalonde article on program evaluation and evaluating econometric estimators. I didn't realize this. What Raif told me was that Hedo and Don Rubin co-taught a class on causal inference. And it's like a part of my, I wouldn't say it's, I don't know if it's a research agenda, but it's a part of a conjecture that I have, which is that causal inference is spreading through relationships more so than even maybe the articles. It's spreading through particular classes and the students in those classes and the students of those students. It's a big part of it because it's a long time. It's a long, long time before there's a textbook that you would say is kind of a causal inference textbook for economists, and that would be mostly harmless econometrics. 2008 or 2009, I can never remember which year it is, but this is in the mid 90s. And had Bruce just been 1 year earlier at Harvard, there is no telling what would have happened. He had two big influences from what you're going to hear at Harvard: Ed Glaeser and Hedo and Rubin. So that's part of it, okay? But on a personal level, and I didn't quite say this because I didn't want to make him uncomfortable, but this is, now he's listening, he can hear this. I have had a real admiration for Bruce Sacerdote, and I'm probably, it's a big club, is the sense I get, or I don't know if it's the sense I get, but like I have had a real admiration for Bruce for a long, long time because he wrote a bunch of papers on crime with Ed Glaeser very, very early on, and they were very different. They were not your like traditional crime papers. A lot of the empirical literature on crime is a lot of stuff on Becker deterrence, and that's not really the kind of stuff that Ed Glaeser and Bruce Sacerdote were writing. They were very unusual. They had a lot to do with, like, for instance, vengeance, which I thought was kind of cool, or social interactions. Now, so I was really mesmerized because I love studying theory, and I love crime, and I was always desperate for like new theoretical insights on the economics of crime. And so I loved Bruce's work, but what really, really stole my heart was this Quarterly Journal of Economics paper that he did on the randomization of roommates at Dartmouth and its effects on the creation of friends. And that really did me in. It kind of hit a bunch of buttons because, first of all, I love friends. I love being a friend. I love having friends. Friends are, to me, one of the most special of all the social interactions that there are, maybe even more than a romantic partner. It's its own thing. With your romantic partner, okay, you fall in love. I guess it's like a romantic partner, but it's different than like kids, at least. It's different than family because I love my sister, I love my brother, love my mom and dad. But I got probably some biological reasons. It's like imprinted, something's going on. Friendship is unique, it's unique. And most important, I'm still friends with my college friends. We get together. I don't get to do it as much as I want. We get together every year, or I go about half the time because now I'm traveling too much, but we go camping. And or another buddy of mine, we see each other, and buddies. That's what I call my friends. I call them buddies. And I just love them. And so this paper Bruce wrote about friendship and was just mellow to me reading it. But then secondly, the thing that meant a lot to me was he was using lotteries. He's using a lottery, physical randomized roommates. And even then, when that paper came out, even then, I sensed there was something different. My paradigm, I undergo a, my paradigm was not causal inference when I exited graduate school. It's like so hard for people to understand, listening, young people, that it was that the causal inference credibility revolution was like a paradigm shift, like a Thomas Kuhn scientific revolution, paradigm shift, see the whole world differently. But when I interview people that like learned from these guys, they were graduate schools, they were graduate students. It's like they were Josh Anger students, and several times when I talked to them and I was like, well, what was it like, to learn this stuff? And they were like, well, that's all I've ever known. And that's over and over and over again, and so it's always been like kind of crazy for me because I've always been outside it. And so it was this big, big, big wall I had to climb over. And that's where the book came from. The book came from, 8 years of teaching this class that I had prepped that I'd kind of piecemealed together for a long, long time. And the mixtape was my like finally feeling like I had climbed over the wall and at least understood what was on the wall and on the other side of the wall. And Bruce's paper on that peer effects thing, I knew something was up because it wasn't just a regression, even though it was a regression. That's the whole thing with these paradigm shifts. It's a regression and it's not a regression. He's using physical randomized treatment assignments and then he's running regressions on physical randomization, knowing where the treatment assignment's coming from, that it's coming from coin flips. I could tell, even though I didn't have the words for treatment assignment mechanism, I don't even know if the randomization part, I could tell something was like powerful. And there was a few times early on that that was the case in Bruce's work, Bruce's papers, because I was so interested in these kinds of like off the beaten path kind of questions. I mean, I was never really interested in education. I know it's a very important topic. I know that education is like, one of the biggest anti-poverty programs in the world, and anti-crime programs in the world. But I loved, He's studying islands. He's studying friends. He's studying peer effects. He's, you know, these things just meant the world to me. So that's a long introduction to Bruce Sacerdote. I'm going to turn it over to Scott Cunningham interviewing Bruce Sacerdote. I highly encourage you to go read all of Bruce's papers, all of them. There's a bunch, and they're great. And he's a very smart man. He's a very nice person, and I really enjoyed this interview. Thanks a lot for tuning in, and I'll see you in like 1 minute. You'll see my face with the same shirt on. All right. Well, it is my pleasure to have on the show this week someone that I only met you, Bruce, randomly at the ASSA. You were walking on the sidewalk with Jim West.
I remember that well. Yes.
Well, could you, for the sake of the listener, tell us your full name, your full title, even the long one, and who pays your bills?
Right. Good question. So I am Bruce Sacerdote. I'm the Richard S. Braddock 1963 Professor of Economics at Dartmouth. I'm also at the NBER, the National Bureau of Economic Research. I'm on loan at the Treasury. I am a researcher at the Census, and importantly, I am a co-chair of the J-PAL North America State and Local Innovation Initiative. And
Oh,
so
wow.
all of those have interesting stories and papers behind them.
Oh, that's crazy. That's the most. So you win the most so far of the long title of anybody I've
Yes.
interviewed.
And I will say, I'll interject that the namesake of my title, Rick Braddock, and the Braddock family are truly amazing folks and entrepreneurs and big supporters of Dartmouth and of research. But were instrumental in the founding of a lot of really neat companies, including like Priceline and FreshDirect and
Oh,
other
wow.
things. So yeah, they're really neat, really neat family and group of people. And
Oh,
I enjoyed
so
talking
they're
with them.
Dartmouth alums too.
They are,
And
yes. Yeah.
you met them. They endowed your chair and you sort of have a relationship with them too a little bit.
Exactly. That's right.
Oh, that's
You're
cool.
right. Yeah.
That's really cool. Well, let's do an icebreaker before we get started. If you think back as far as you can go, what's a vacation that you went on that you've thought about a couple of times since then? Doesn't have to be your favorite, doesn't have to be when you were a kid. It's just something that you've kind of noticed. Hey, I'm thinking of that vacation again.
You know, it's funny that you asked that because for me, going on vacation is 90% to look back on it because while I'm in it, it can be like really hard work. We have three kids; they're two of which are grown now and out of the house. But for me, 90% of going on vacation is looking back on it and thinking about the beauty of it. And I have a few obsessions in life. One of them, the main one, is skiing, and so we have, when possible, kind of an annual trip out to Colorado, and we ski really hard. And so I reflect on trips to different mountains in Colorado all the time, whether it's Vail or whether it's Aspen Highlands or somewhere else. Another obsession I have is sailing or boating, really. And I'm not a great sailor, but I love boating. And so we've had some great family trips down to the Virgin Islands where we do what's called bare boat charter, where they'll rent you the boat and just the boat, and you go buy provisions and sail that boat around with the use of a map, of course, and a GPS.
Wow, I was actually going to ask you about boating because both your undergraduate thesis and even a paper later, kind of, I could tell I was going to ask you about it. So, has boating been in your family?
Yeah, forever. It kind of started with my grandfather, who was a an up and comer, first generation college goer, but kind of an up and comer at Bethlehem Steel, and rose to run the tool and die division at Bethlehem Steel, and then ran other parts of Bethlehem Steel. And he was really into it. In those days, in the 50s and 60s, it was kind of a marker of success and something fun you did with your family, and so he taught himself to sail. He bought a series of old boats and patched the holes in them and hand-built trailers for them. And my whole family got into boating more and more, and then diving, boating and honestly diving and snorkeling too, as a result of that.
So you do, so y that's wild. So you love being in the hot weather and the cold weather.
Yeah, exactly. And I have to be honest, I'm more of a cold weather person. I tolerate the hot weather because I love reef diving and catching lobsters and diving on wrecks and things. But I like the hot weather for being in the water, not for necessarily playing baseball or tennis or something in 95
But
weather.
you're outside all the time, all
All
year
the time.
round.
Yep, all year.
Wow. Wow. So what's the furthest you've ever gone on a boat?
Well, you know, it's interesting, and I'm kind of a chicken. So the furthest distance we ever covered, I spent a lot of time out at the sight of land, you know, out 5, 8 miles offshore, whether it's fishing or diving. But the furthest we ever sailed was simply we went from Grenada. We picked up a boat in Grenada a couple of years ago, my family and I, and we sailed it north to like St. Vincent and the Grenadines, which, you know, we're only talking like 24 miles in, I would call it relatively open ocean, but that's you know, I'm a piker because when we arrived at our destination, we ran into folks from the Netherlands who sailed across the ocean from Europe in the same size boat, mind you, not in a bigger boat or a different boat, the exact same boat. They brought it over from Europe. So
What's the probability of getting into trouble doing something like that? I know it's fallen over time, but is it's not trivial?
yeah, not trivial. I'm a real chicken and am almost always within sight of land, and we've all got phones, often within cell phone service, always within radio service and checking the weather constantly. So I'm a real chicken. So, you know, the chances of getting into trouble for me are relatively low. But certainly sailing across the ocean, I'd say a lot higher.
That's still some courage. That's some
Yeah, I
that's
agree.
some, yeah, okay. So you where did you grow up? Did you grow up around where you are right now? No, you said
Yeah,
Bethlehem
pretty
still.
close. Walpole, Mass, which is south of Boston, kind of near where the Patriots play at Gillette Stadium. And it was a nice, it's a nice suburban town. It was kind of a blue collar and partly agrarian town when I was there, but it's gotten everything in Boston has really mushroomed, just like everything in Texas. And so it's a lot more populated than it was when I grew up. And my parents had the foresight to buy a place on a lake. And so we're in boats and fishing and snorkeling and swimming, you know, 9 months, eight months a year or something on that lake.
The gradient between a normal house and buying a house on the lake when you were, when they were younger is probably a lot smaller than
A
now.
lot smaller. It was like, well, you could buy on one side of the street to the other side of the street, and you know, instead of costing $15,000 or $18,000, the side of the street with the lake was $20,000 for the house, right? And so yeah, that's exactly right. Like that, I think that's a function of income growth, that as incomes have gone up like crazy, of course, there's a fixed amount of real estate it's super, super desirable. And so people are putting more and more of their income into housing and real estate,
That
right?
house that got passed down to the kids.
Yeah, my brother and I had it for many years. And then I was living up here, and Dean had his own home and then ended up moving to Texas, and so Florida and then Texas. And so we ended up selling it.
Oh, you
It was,
did.
yeah, it's a neat lake. We do have a little cottage on a lake here that's about the same size here in the Upper Valley in Hanover and Enfield, New Hampshire. We also did get a small cottage down on Martha's Vineyard. So we've not gone far from the water, and
I
we've
mean,
got
if you love
cottage.
skiing and you love water, you sort of have to make some real estate investments a little bit, right? Or some
Well,
investments
yeah,
in
or be
capital.
willing to drive. Yeah. It's one of those things where when it comes to these lake houses, a lot of things we've invested in a lot of cases in things that are hard to rent, you know. Ski condos you can rent. You know, there's a good, if you like going to the Outer Banks, there's a really robust market for renting in the Outer Banks. Renting Martha's Vineyard, that's hard. Super expensive, and you got to plan 12 months ahead and get ferry reservations, that stuff. So when we got tired of that, we said, okay, we got to try to buy a place. It's going to be a strange trip. We're gonna have to hunt. But like, there are thick markets and thin markets for rentals, and renting a lake place around here, that's a thin market. It's mostly owners like us that have condos.
And they don't want to do it. They because
Don't
they're wanting
want
to be there in the summer. They're wanting
to.
to,
Exactly. Right.
That's right. Yeah, they're wanting to. They're not doing like Airbnb. I guess there's some Airbnbs,
Little bit, yeah. You gotta hunt for it, and you gotta, and that's, to me, all that planning is stressful, and just having a place around the corner where we can keep our boat is ideal.
So when you were little, like what, like maybe middle school, what do you what so what are you doing to play games and stuff like that? What's your favorite pastime when you're like middle schooler?
It was interesting because I took up tennis. Unlike my kids, I'm not much of an athlete, and so I was okay at baseball. And I mean, okay is a generous term. And there weren't, remember when we were kids, there weren't as many sports and sports opportunities. Obviously, crew didn't exist. Lacrosse was just getting started. It's not that crew didn't exist; it didn't exist for all, any kids in public high schools. So baseball and soccer were kind of, football were kind of where it's at, and some basketball. And I wasn't good in football or basketball, and so I played baseball, and then I took up tennis because it was something that was a skill sport that fewer people did. That, even if you weren't a tremendously gifted athlete, you could do it, and it was an individual sport. And I learned a bit about skiing. And then when I got to Dartmouth, I learned a ton about skiing.
But you are, it sounds like you are athletic though. You're very active. You are very
Yeah,
active.
active for my age. I've kind of maintained a level of activity, and as we've gotten older, I feel like for my age, I feel pretty active right now. But as a as an 18-year-old, I was not a very skilled athlete. I'm pretty slow, right? Running. So many sports involve speed and running, and
Are you
I'm
tall? Are
side.
you pretty
Yeah, I'm
tall?
6 feet.
Oh,
I'm
okay.
a bit more than 6 feet. Of course, nowadays for pitchers in baseball and stuff, 6 feet can be short, or at least it's not tall, right? And for basketball, forget it, right? That's not much at all,
So do you end up going to a big high school? And is it in the Bo it's still in this rural part of Boston?
Yeah, and of course it's not rural any longer, Walpole. And I think I'm probably going to get this wrong. I feel like we had 300 people in my graduating class, so not crazy big, but a lot bigger than Hanover High.
Yeah, maybe the, yeah, okay. Well, so if I could have eavesdropped in the faculty teacher lounge in high school and sort of, and they're talking about Bruce Sacerdote, this, junior in high school, what are these teachers saying, the kind of student you are and where they think you're going?
Probably that I was good at math, had a big mouth, and was going somewhere. Terrible athlete, because even the teachers in those days cared a lot about athletics. And Walpole was appropriately very proud of his football team. I was, barely a contributor on the tennis team. And the other, my peers were doing like three sports, two or three sports, and excelling at it. And probably figuring that I was bound for some elite selective school, because I was good and I was doing well in most subjects. And I was particularly, I really liked languages, believe it or not. It's funny, for an economist, I'm not a super duper math person. Like high school math, college math, sure, I can. I did well in calculus, but that's about as far. When you and I sit through a theory seminar, I'm lost about midway into it, or at least I lose interest,
So they're like, he's good in math. He's not a great athlete, but where do they think you're going to go? What kind of kid do they think you're becoming?
I don't know what they thought career-wise. Probably I had a lot of interest in business and finance, and so they probably thought I was going to do something businessy or entrepreneurial, start a business kind of thing. Very outspoken, so maybe law or politics or something where there's a lot of talking. But
Well, so you, what did you want to be?
it's interesting. I can't remember quite that far. I think I was interested in either starting a business, inventing something, or working in finance in some capacity, but some entrepreneurial capacity, not that I was opposed to, say, working at a bank, but more like running money, like buying firms, changing firms, that kind of thing,
That's what you were
which is,
thinking.
yeah, and that's what I teach right now. That's the kind of thing, I even though I'm a labor economist, I teach a finance class. I'm actually I've had a couple different flavors of this finance class, and I'm teaching a new one next year. So that's still a big interest of mine, and that is what I teach. That is what I teach.
Well, so you end up going to Dartmouth, and I always feel funny asking people, why'd you go to Harvard or why'd you go to Dartmouth? Because it's
Yeah.
like, you went to, I'm sure you went to, but was there something about Dartmouth that you got you kind of excited as a
Yeah,
kid?
I mean it's a really beautiful place, and it's very outdoorsy, and I'm currently on a committee to we're very interested at Dartmouth in student wellness, and I have created this committee to boost outdoor engagement among the students. Not that there's not a lot
Oh.
already relative to the average college, but there always could be more, and it could be more universal, and we've got so many different opportunities out there. You
Yeah,
know,
that.
we own our own ski hill. We own our own Nordic facility. You know,
Right,
that's
right.
just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, tons of riverfront. Crew, massive crew docks, and a Ledyard canoe club. And we're the second, next to the state, we're the second biggest landholder in New Hampshire.
So when you were a high school kid, because you grew up, around water and mountains and stuff, Dartmouth having all this natural amenities and being a great school, it was just, it was really
It was a
attractive.
gimme. Yeah, it
Yeah.
was a gimme. And it's interesting because in those days, Dartmouth was among the selective schools. Dartmouth was a really up and coming place. And frankly, maybe it was just the people I was talking to, but like it was very highly ranked. And among the Ivies, people would, other than Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, it was considered a super desirable place to attend, Yeah, and and other schools have in some ways caught up or changed. I mean, these places have all grown enormously in terms of what they do intellectually and what facilities they have and what kind of endowments they have and stuff, But at the time that I was attending Dartmouth, it was quite unique, and there weren't that many. There was a very short list of places that the average student would have considered to be a competitor of it.
Comparable to that.
Yeah.
Okay. So, when I speak with a lot of economists on the podcast, it seems like, the thing that draws them into economics, kind of like that fire that makes them go into it, maybe is either a book, a class, or a professor, or then there's just some random thing. And I was just kind of curious if you think back to that, first moment when you were like, man, this is really doing it for me. What was it that really captivated you?
That's a great question. And I think for me, I mean, it's really odd because it's not in those days. My grad school experience explains a lot of what I do for research now. But my undergrad experience was that there were a couple of different classes that really rang a bell with me. And there was a professor here named Jane Mather, in those days, who taught a macro class. And I loved that all these, really what non-economists thought of as mysterious concepts like the Fed and interest rates and money supply and fiscal stimulus, which are these really mysterious things to the average person, it all just seemed so clear in this. Again, this is like the intro macro course, right? So it seems so perfect. And I remember one of the student who was a year older than me, and he was he's just like, okay, so GNP is C plus I plus G plus net exports. And you have this curve. So what's the problem? Like, he's like, it seems like we got this all figured out. I don't even need to understand why we have these recessions, and it was kind of, and so it was that feeling of finally understanding basic things about the world, not the physical world, but the economic, social
The
world. I was
social
like,
world.
wow, that's really cool, that this fits together, and I like that. And then I had a an econometrics professor named Dave Stapleton, who I mean, I had a vague idea that there were there was programming statistical techniques out there to write empirical papers, but it was really great to take that class with him and learn about how to use data to to answer questions. So that was
This
fun.
undergraduate thesis you do on vertical integration in boating, was that pretty common to have, that kind of, I mean, from the title of it, that's like actual, IO.
Yeah, and it's funny. And it's an interesting question as to why I did IO, as opposed to, in hindsight, I would have told myself to do straight up labor and come up with, of course, this is now having taken post taking, Hedo Inbens, learned from Hedo Inbens and Josh Angrist and Ed Glaser and Claudia Golden and Larry Katz. I was, oh, well, just do straight labor and find some interesting shock where you could study. A difference in differences or regression discontinuity, but I didn't know about any of that as an undergrad, and I knew
Right.
I was interested in how businesses worked and how what drove profits and what drove monopoly and pricing and things. And of course, I was interested in boating, as you know. And I had so we had a great set of faculty here who studied IO, including Lee Baldwin, who
Oh, yeah.
thesis advisor, and Jim Dana, who I believe is still at Northeastern. He was at Dartmouth for many years, and now I believe he's at Northeastern, married to Kathy Spear, who's a lawn econ person. And so we had those great resources because we had these wonderful faculty, and I had this interest in business and profits and monopoly pricing. And so I
Oh.
and so I it seemed pretty at the time it seemed pretty natural to go down that road.
And you just knew so much of the boating industry.
Yeah, I
Tara.
knew it, but yeah, and it was fun. And I guess I knew, and this is kind of rings true today with how I go about a project. I knew it would be very fun to talk to the manufacturers who'd done these mergers and to, collect prices and different models and consider like how product differentiation might be driving some of this and how cost savings might be driving some of this, So,
Was
yeah,
it a
definitely.
very empirical paper? Was it a very empirical
You
thesis?
know, by today's standards, not at all. I guess I was, I have to go back and look at it, but I was trying to figure out whether the lower prices. So, it's actually not that surprising that it at first blush you might think it's surprising that like all this integration lowered prices, right? But it was through there's some obvious productivity gains that they realized, and so I was trying to model, I was trying to estimate both supply and demand in this in this certain segment, the segment of boats that you might use on a lake for skiing and fishing and things. Your basic family lake boat. And so I was trying to estimate supply and demand. So it was empirical in that sense.
Well, was that around when you are writing that thesis? Is this beginning to solidify for you that you're wanting to become a PhD economist?
Yeah, and what really changed, it's funny, I just thought of this when you asked that. The big, because I did better than I expected at this economics thing and really liked was more successful academically and more interested in it than I realized. And then so I was off getting in the process of getting business jobs and interviewing at different management consulting firms. And lo and behold, one of the first people I meet is Steve Levitt, who was
Oh, really? What year is this? Like
Yeah,
nine
at
ninety
corporate
two?
decisions. Well, 90, actually, I'm an old guy, so 1990.
Where do you meet Levitt?
So there was a firm that's now must be part of Mercer Oliver Wyman, but it was called Corporate Decisions. It was a very elite boutique consulting firm, and a friend of mine named Jevon Eagle, who's now a professor at Boston University, he was working there. He's an older fraternity brother of mine, 2 years older, and I really admired what he was doing, and I interviewed with CDI and didn't get the job, but fortunately got to meet Steve Levitt, who was 1 year between me and Jevon, and we had a great conversation. And there was no one else in the room, so it was very easy for him to say, like, look, really, what you should think about going get your PhD in economics, and here's why, and here's the kind of things that economists do, and here's what it takes. And honestly, that was the first time that opened my eyes to this as a possibility, and that
Wow.
people actually did this, and that it was a good job, and that I'd have a shot at getting in. And then that gets back to Jim Dana and Kathy Spear. Kathy was at the time on the recruiting committee at Harvard and married to Jim. And so, I had someone who could provide a recommendation for me that I would be good at this. And so that was very fortuitous, extremely fortuitous.
So you get to Harvard. What was that first year experience like at Harvard? You've got this calculus that you feel good at, but what's Harvard's first year sequence like back in 92?
Pretty intense.
Yeah, I bet.
The two things to know about it was by and large, to a first approximation, it was run by the theorists. And the econometric sequence was excellent. Involved Hedo and Gary Chamberlain, and Dale Jorgensen. But also,
Wow.
a very high level of math and proofs and things.
What's Hedo teaching that first year?
So I think it was a statistics
Yeah,
class.
yeah. I
Yeah, he
heard
was a
that
former statistician.
I heard Chamberlain called him to teach a probability statistics class. That
Yep, I
was,
think
yeah.
that's exactly what it was. Yeah, so I took that and I learned a lot more about moment generating functions and PDFs and CDFs than I needed to know. So it was the level of math was what it was really interesting because I'll say a couple things about it. The level of math was much more than what I expected, but okay, I could get I could survive because I had some great classmates who were MIT undergraduates, Mike Pascuti and Emil Deborah and Maya Fetterman. And so the MIT students could help me with the math. Because of Dave Stapleton's class and writing that thesis, I could help them with basic computer programming and run, like the idea. I mean, it sounds ridiculous now because my undergraduates do this all day long, but the idea of grabbing a data set, reading it into what was then SAS or TSP, time series processing, and running regressions was like nothing to me. But to a group of brand new graduate students who've been fed nothing but theory and math for 4 years, this was like a big deal to like fire up a computer, suck the data into SAS, and make tables and things, And so I could be helpful to my peers on that, and they were enormously helpful to me on the harder stuff. And so that was a total blast. And the other piece, another piece of this, which
Are you
raises,
guys using personal computers?
yes, that's a good question. So some of this is happening on personal computers, but a lot of it is happening on me connecting into, I think the TSP stuff was on the PC. But all the SAS stuff was on some servers at Harvard, some boxes that you would tie into. And frankly, the programming for that hasn't changed that much. If you want to use SAS, it still looks a hell of a lot like it did back in 1992. So this was done on their machines. The funny thing was that some of the data I met, the next part of the story was, I think it was in my second year, but it might have been my first year, I met Ed Glaser, who was a brand new assistant professor. Was super interested, not just in urban economics and working with him on empirical pro I was it was more I was at least as interested in working with him on empirical projects as I was in urban per se, because I found labor and education just as interesting as urban. But met him and we started working on papers, and I enjoyed writing code and merging data sets, and I still have behind me a bunch of tapes, because part of the, I can't even believe we did this in those days, but you get these big old tapes like with crime reports, uniform crime reports data or census data on them, and you'd have to load them onto a machine that would read them. And conditional on if you could, God forbid that would work, you would then store it on these smaller DAT tapes. There were these smaller tapes that we would load the working data set onto once we actually had what we needed.
And so wait, what's Ed got to do with that?
Oh, with the data part? Well, we started working on papers together, and obviously he couldn't do all the empirics himself, because he was writing five papers at once. And so it was a heck of a lot of work to contact the FBI, have them FedEx me the tape, figure out which tapes we needed, work ICPSR, see what things were easily downloadable from ICPSR versus what we had to obtain elsewhere. And I would do that, and I would merge stuff together and bring it back to him, and then we would design the analysis, and then I would go off and implement it, and
So
so we would.
you're got this comparative advantage at Harvard of being an empiricist already.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and it's
Even
not like,
com
yeah, go ahead.
even compared to Glaser.
Well, I would say, I guess you'd say comparative advantage. I mean, Ed has an absolute advantage in everything, but yeah, clearly my comparative advantage was not writing down the structural model. It was merging the data and getting that together. And it was interesting because Ed's talent, it wasn't just in, you know, he was talented not just in writing code, but he has this ability and had then, and I'm sure still has now, to look at a data set and be like, oh no, this is the regression you want to run. And you know, if we get some funny answer, you'd be like, oh, you didn't weight the regression. Like it would take him 2 seconds. He wouldn't have to look at the code. He could just look at the output and be like, oh yeah, like, you need to control for a lag dependent variable here, or like that variable is clearly incredibly noisy, or that dummy variable must only be, positive for 5% of the observations or something.
Right,
You
right,
just
right.
look at, he could look at output, really simple output from anything, and be like, oh yeah, that's not how we want to do this. So that's not
Yeah.
enough variation, or
Right.
that's plenty of variation. This will work well, you
Right.
know?
Okay, so there's this class, this Hito Imbens, Don Rubin, causal inference co-taught class. When is that? That you in is it the you're in the first person to take that class?
Yeah, I think we were the first class, and I think that's our second year because by my third year, I was bound and determined to just work on my own papers and get stuff out the door. And so I think that was my second year. And needless to say, it was a real eye-opener because I had not a lot of sympathy for, in those days, we were reading a lot of like super structural papers where Ed understood what the identification was and what was driving the estimates, and then he Ed had strong opinions about whether it was BS or whether it was, a good way to do things. I could not follow a lot of them, ones that had many, many equations, and it was really hard to see what variation was identifying the parameters and if
Yeah.
you believe that that was useful, good variation. And so Hito and Don come along and start talking. And obviously they were working with Josh Angers, but I didn't know Josh well yet. But they were talking about a much simpler model of the world where you focus really on the causal effect of X on Y, a program on someone's earnings or on someone's college going or someone's health, and really shrink it down to okay, we are looking for this parameter that would be if you randomly assign people to have this treatment, what would be the impact of the treatment, which is a much simpler world. And in those days, it was hard to have data in that world because everything was observational and we hadn't yet gotten very clever about natural experiments or variation that we would plausibly identify the parameters other than RCTs, which were very rare. But we were coming up with more and more examples, and obviously, even though I wasn't working with David Card and Alan Krueger, they were at the forefront of, and Josh were at the forefront of finding that natural variation and estimating, estimating impacts of
It felt like a
treatments.
minority of papers were doing the natural experiment work when you were like 93, 94.
Oh my God, yeah, and they were. But the great thing was, it wasn't. It was a minority of papers, but they were highly, highly respected. So very few people were saying, oh yeah, this is bullshit. You're just looking at like twins, that have different amounts of education. People were super interested in that and super respectful of it. And to the extent that people had RCTs or random variation, we're referring to that as like the gold standard of how to do empirical work, and of course, IVs that weren't perfect natural experiments were still great demand and greatly used. And so it became obvious to me, not only did I want to write those kind of papers, but they were going to play well in the journals, which they did, right?
So you come up with this lottery idea while you're in that class. What happened?
Yes.
What's the origin of that paper?
Because Don Rubin was constantly talking about randomization and, God has done the randomization that lets you like identify this parameter.
Because
And
he's
so
talking about observational data.
talking about observational data and natural experiments and how, and a lot of his focus was on the fact that we we often don't have, random variation. And so therefore, we will use control methods like the propensity score in various
Right.
ways. You could
Right.
lock on the propensity score, you could control for it in a regression, and you could weight by the propensity score to weight the control observations to look like the treatment. So he's talking about all these things, but always in the background is this idea that, if you had randomly assigned treatment, that's really what you're after. That's what we're trying to approximate. So it's obviously not a very big leap from that to think about, well, the lottery is the most obvious thing, at the time, the mass state lottery, but the lottery in general is the most obvious example of true randomization that, is occurring in human life, and
Yep.
it looks to me.
Yep.
And
That
I was
comes
thinking
to you
about,
in the class. What
what's
in
that?
class? That comes to you in the class.
Oh
Like
yeah,
during the
I think
class, you're
during
like,
class, it could have been after class, but yeah, it
yeah.
was just, to me, that's like a, I mean, Don referred to it as an insight, but I mean, that's just like totally straightforward that
Yeah.
like, I mean, it's not that, like I'm working on this paper right now where we're using children, military families are quasi randomly assigned to different bases around the country and around the world. And my co-authors and I have co-authors at the Army and co-authors at Treasury, and we've merged all this together. And that what where was I going with this? Like I think that's like super interesting, but that's at least one step less obvious than the lottery, where there's the whole
Right.
purpose of it is randomization, right? Like
Randomization.
randomization.
But they end up wanting to work on it. They must get excited about
Yes.
the project.
Oh yeah. And it was one of those things where I'm really glad that I wrote the paper with them. I thought of the idea. I decided that we needed money for it, and I, with a lot of hubris, thought, oh, we'll just apply for an NSF. And of course, because they were involved, I now know, first of all, there were a lot fewer economists back then, and so everything was easier than it is today. But also with those two superstars, it was doable to get
Tito's
the.
already a superstar at this point.
Yeah, like everyone knew that he was one of the smartest people in his field, right?
Yeah.
And so we got some money from National Science Foundation to run a survey of
Oh,
mass
so
state
that's how you
lottery.
get the data. You don't get administrative data, but you knew all the names of the people.
Right. So we went to mass state lottery, and we convinced the person. I think the person we were working with was the like head of outside relations or something. And she was great. She was terrific, and had some connections to Dartmouth. Wasn't a Dartmouth grad herself, but was very accommodating and understood what we wanted to do, and allowed us to run a survey of people who had won big and small prizes.
Was that exciting to work on that project?
Oh yeah, it was great. And I regret a few things about it. You see, I was not at that moment dead set on becoming an academic economist. I just wanted to do this cool paper with Don and Hedo, and then maybe go off and start a firm or something. And also keep in mind that at this time, we're talking 1992, 93, jobs for economists are relative today few and far between. Like it didn't pay that much. I'm trying to think, like, my first job at Dartmouth paid, it was considered a big deal because it paid like $50,000. Like it paid enough that you wouldn't starve to death.
Yeah,
But
right.
Harvard was paying like people $50,000 or $70,000 tops to come work as economists. It was not, which was way less than what consulting firms were paying undergraduates to come work with them. Okay. So it's like, and there weren't that many jobs. Like the class ahead of me at the time I was working on this paper, the 20 people in the class ahead of me, two or three of them got academic jobs.
Is that selection, sorting, they're wanting the jobs, or is it
It's
they're
where the
wanting?
jobs weren't
They
available.
just weren't available. So you
I
get
mean,
these really small annual meetings.
small annual meetings, and the Dartmouth department, I mean, we're a pretty good example, and the Baylor department is probably falls in the same category. Now we have 30 four people, 34 economists, all deeply engaged in research. At the time it was like 12 people or something,
Right.
who were obviously some of whom were deeply engaged in research, but some were more focused on teaching as opposed to a mix of research and teaching. And
Yeah.
so like things just changed. The number of majors, like I don't know what the number of econ majors was when I was an undergraduate here, but it's exploded. It's like 250 a year now, you
You've
know.
watched it get bigger and bigger and bigger over the years?
Oh yeah, it's absolutely taken off, and
Huh.
universities and governments and the Fed have followed suit and hired economists like crazy. And so the
Right.
profession is so much bigger than it was in those days, which
Mm-hmm.
means A, it's now a lot harder to publish things in a great journal or a great field journal. It's much, much harder. But B, there are so many more jobs, and wages are so much higher in real terms than they used to be. And so I had no illusions about becoming an academic economist because it seemed like it was something that three or four people a year did, the very best, most mathematically gifted folks did. And then things just changed. And I was surprised to get a job at, I mean, I was somewhat surprised to get a job at Dartmouth, honestly, and pleased. And I didn't view it at that time as a permanent thing or even something I could afford to do very long. And we had people leave because they couldn't afford, you know, the wages were low enough. You know, we had associate, and in some cases, full professors making 90,000 a year in the late 90s, early 2000s. And so, you know, they couldn't afford to live on that. And so things have changed. You know, things have changed.
So Ed, is he your advisor at
Yeah,
all?
and we worked very closely together. Worked on a lot of cool papers. You know, we did a lot of. We initially did a lot with crime because there weren't, other than Steve Levitt, there weren't that many economists working on crime at that moment. Doing empirical work, there was some great theory work being done, but you know, really getting into the data and estimating, you know, what's driving crime waves, what's driving variation across space in crime.
Your papers are really different. They're not the traditional Beckerian deterrence papers. They've got social, social interaction type things in it and vengeance. They're very original. They're very theoretically novel.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of that is Ed. You know, it was us together coming up with the ideas and me doing the empirical work on them. No, we really, I really enjoyed doing that stuff. And the social interactions aspect, to me, that just made a ton of sense. I mean, honestly, Ed and Jose came up with it. Jose Shankman came up with that concept. But to me, it immediately made a lot of sense as to what would drive it, right? I mean, just seems like social interactions govern so much of human behavior. I mean, it was meeting Steve and Ed that caused me to go get my PhD and write papers and become an academic. So,
Yeah, and then that class with Hito and Ruben
yeah,
seems
it
like
was
it had a
almost random.
lasting influence.
I mean, who knows? I may have even taken it just because the time was convenient. I can't remember what drove me to take that class, but I'm really glad that I did.
Was it a paradigm kind of for your way of thinking of empiricism to think of it as I've got to be finding coin flips in the world for all my projects?
100%. Yes, 100%. And
Like that was
honestly, yeah.
like that next cohort ahead of you might not have had that framework.
Correct. I would absolutely agree with that. That they were thinking more like, okay, I need to write down a model of this and decide what are the key parameters and give a little bit of thought to how, in my estimation, what's behind the identification of those parameters. Not that idea of really narrowing in on the identification, where the identification takes primacy over the idea almost.
So,
The idea is the identification, not the economic insight.
I must have known about your crime papers because that was early on my area too. But I think that the first time I learned of your work, it was this really cool paper on friendship with
Yes.
at the. So I'm just curious, I mean, I love that idea that you studied it. I think that's just probably what jumped off the page when I saw it. But when did you first notice that Dartmouth was randomizing roommates?
You know, it's a really good question. And that probably in my first year here when I got back in 98. And I don't remember the moment, but I can't remember whether it was I found out that they were randomizing or that I wanted to study roommates and I was hoping that it was pretty random in how they did it. I think it was kind of the latter that maybe I was thinking about this idea of People have thought about the impact of when you get sent off to prison, like who your cellmate is may have an
Totally.
impact on your future. It might have been something like that.
Yeah, because you're working on crime, you're working on social interaction.
Yeah, it could have been that, or it could have been this idea. And I now I'm struggling to remember the paper, but there's a very famous sociological paper that might rely on the assignment of staff and junior faculty into housing, maybe around MIT, and how that random allocation of where you live had impacts. And I think that put it in my head, hey, I should find out about how Dartmouth assigns roommates, because that could be a really cool thing to do.
Yeah.
That not surprisingly, that ended up being the attention or citations of that paper ended up being way in excess of what I would have anticipated. I thought it was a very neat, fun paper to do. I thought I would be greatly constrained by the fact that it was Dartmouth, and
Right.
wasn't a bigger set.
Yeah.
But people got excited again. The methodology ended up taking primacy over the setting, and
Yeah,
so
sure,
people were just
sure.
excited about the methodologies.
Yeah. Well, when's Mansky talking about this mirroring problem? Is that at the same time? You know, I mean,
I think
so it,
I'm surely he predates my paper,
yeah.
because when I was citing him, it was stuff that he had already published. And I think, like a lot of my papers, I kind of dive in with 2 feet, and then people have to be like, oh, you're kind of missing this like key literature that went before you 10 years ago that you
Right.
need to incorporate in there. And I think it might have been Ed that pointed out to me that okay, but Mansky has has provided this framework for the identification problem in social interactions, and you got to incorporate that in what you're doing.
But am I putting words in your mouth that you're hearing in your back of your mind that class at Harvard though, which is
Oh,
that
absolutely.
there's a coin
Absolutely.
flip. Regardless, the solution is going to be if there is a solution, it's going to be they're flipping coins on who's going to be with who.
Absolutely. And
Yeah.
even before the roommates, I got going on the roommate thing. I remember I was working at a hedge fund temporarily before the Dartmouth job came through. And I remember being on the phone with Michael Kramer a couple times because he had mentioned to Ed that there's, Disney built a town. They wanted to build the suburb of the future. And so they built a town called Celebration that they laid out in a very specific way. And built up the school system and set up the public goods and all everything to their liking, and including the structure of the houses and the distances and things. And then there was people were lotteried into it because more people wanted to live there than they had supply. And so Kramer had noticed this and had Ed put him in touch with me because I worked on that type of paper. And so we had a lot of back and forth, and I got in touch with Disney about studying the if they did they have the lottery list, did they have the list of applications that could we study it? And we never were able to launch that project, but that's one of many examples
Oh,
of lotteries that
the
I was
lottery
asked.
is, you're thinking of lotteries a lot.
A lot, yeah.
Oh.
Immigration lotteries, right? So like the and I wish I had been on all these great charter school lottery papers that Josh and Sue Donarski and many others have written, because those are super important. I mean,
Yeah.
that's a fundamental question. It's like, how do we provide a better school that provides value? And for the same price, right?
Yeah.
The same price, how do we provide a better school? And so those lottery papers with schools are just enormously important. And Brian Jacob and Steve Levitt and others and Julie Cullen have worked on that too
Yeah.
in Chicago. But I'm particularly I usually end up citing these Boston ones because I think they
Well,
spot.
it's funny, like instrumental variables, you really can't reuse them, but lotteries, they literally can be reused because
Yeah.
they're always rolling the dice. It's funny how you can't really build up human capital in your instrument, but in your case, you become like deeply in the weeds on how to go about doing this because it's like a physical randomization.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, no,
Huh.
that's totally right. And
Yeah.
yeah, and it's surprising. I mean, it's not like they're a dime a dozen, but I'm always impressed when policymakers are using lotteries because it would be the normal thing to do, right? You think if you have something valuable, you would tend to, you're tempted to give it out based on who bothers you the most or based on some sort of patronage, right? And so so it's always great when some policymakers obviously do are like, well, look, we have excess demand, let's lottery, you know, or require to, because their supervisors or their you know, the politicians who oversee them say, look, you've got to make this fair, so you've got to lottery, you've got to make it up.
Well, I want to move to this issue of Dartmouth bringing back the SAT and the ACT and then seeing these other schools. But, before we even said that, I was just kind of curious, and this kind of just random thought that came to my head, what exactly has ChatGPT done to play a role in schools bringing back the standardized test, or is that not part of the story at all?
Well, I don't want to say it's not part of the story. It's not something I've dug into. I would say if I were channeling our Dean of Admission, Lee Coffin, I would say that at the moment he didn't bring that up at all. And I would say that he is not panicked that the essays that are being written by ChatGPT. I mean, honestly, and these are my words, not his. I would be more concerned about essays being written or coached by highly paid consultants than written by ChatGPT. But I think that part is really an issue because we want to give every possible opportunity to less advantaged high achieving students. And so the SAT is in many ways, or testing is in many ways, a fantastic way to do that because it's far less biased than a guidance counselor essay, which, you know, the more time, the higher paid and the more time per student a guidance counselor has, the better their recommendation is going to be, or the polish on an essay. And I'm sure there's such a thing as a college essay being too polished, that it doesn't really, it's not really the person speaking. And I think the admissions officers can sense that at times. So I think that without thinking about ChatGPT specifically, I think that really these test scores are a great leveler and a great an additional useful signal about ability to do college level work.
But you're working on this, right? You're working on
Oh
this.
yeah,
So what are you
absolutely.
doing?
Oh, so you know, in some ways, I'm at the tail end of that research. I'm doing this with Doug Steger and Michelle Tyne and Liz Cassio, and we dug into this at the request of Dartmouth. And the key conclusion, the bottom line, is that we find that test score optional policies can actually be harmful to less advantaged students because they don't know when to submit. Test scores are used in context, meaning that like a 1400, you know, coming from my high school, a 1400 is fine, but not really all that great. Coming from a high school with fewer resources and where only 40% of the kids go off to college, a 1400 may be a fantastic score. And understandably, applicants don't know that because how would they? The faculty don't fully understand the way in which test scores are used in context. So you certainly can't expect the applicants to be aware of this. And so we show empirically that students tend to undersubmit, particularly when you have a test optional policy, particularly the less advantaged students. They submit at about the same rate given their score as all the other students, when in reality they should be submitting at higher rates given their score, because scores are used in context. And so Dartmouth is missing out on some high achieving kids from more unusual backgrounds. And we made that point, and
This is using Dartmouth data. Is what are you do you take advantage of this little natural experiment too, of this like losing these people
yes.
or
Yeah,
losing the
in a
score?
way, you know, it's interesting because in a way, we have some diff and diff, but the real comparison, the key comparison that we do is less advantaged, and a key comparison that we do is the less advantaged versus the more advantaged students in the after period, those that give their scores and don't give their scores, conditional on the score. Because we have a set of students who don't have their scores used in the admissions process, but for whom we later observed the score because it was on their high school transcript, or they asked College Board to submit it, even though they later decided not to use it. And so we can actually look at it. We can look at rates of score submission by SAT, but also rates of admission and how that varies, controlling for SAT, how admission varies by being less advantaged or more advantaged. And so, we're able to see that the high achieving, less advantaged students don't submit enough. And so rather than have some complex policy in which we try to encourage them to submit scores, we just say, okay, well, we're just going to reinstate test scores. That seems to make a lot more sense to
How do you
us.
nudge people that don't know to send stuff? What does Dartmouth need to do? They need to communicate
Yeah, so
to
what
these
Dartmouth has
schools.
done is just say, you know what, starting with this next admission cycle, we're going to require test scores. So it's, this is a classic. I said this in a meeting the other day. It's a classic. We were explaining this to students. It's a classic example of too much choice is bad, or like, sure, we could have this very complex informational policy where we try to help everyone understand the implications of sending their score, given their score and given their family background. But instead of doing that, let's just reinstate, test scores for all. And all these students have, the vast majority have taken a variety of tests. And the taking it out is not the hardship. The hard part is the game theory of whether you send or don't send. And so Dartmouth and now many other schools have said, ah, you know what, enough with the game theory. Let's just reinstate. And Dartmouth, Harvard, Columbia, you name it, there's been a whole raft, Brown, there have been a whole raft of schools. MIT had already done this, have ever reinstated.
Well, I told you I would only keep you for an hour, and it's been an hour. And but I have one last question.
Sure.
Thinking back to the kid you were, and let's say that it's not Levitt, that's like, you get a time machine and you go back, and it's not Levitt that's talking to somebody, it's you, right? And they're kind of on the fence, and you just want to tell them your story about why it is that you really are grateful that you went this route rather than something else. What are you going to tell that kid about why it was that this was something that was, you used to feel like was a meaningful choice to make?
Yeah, it's interesting because it goes back, that's a great question, and it goes back to something Ed said to me. Ed, because Ed was also, Ed w went to Princeton, graduated in 3 years, and was an absolute academic superstar. I could have done anything he wanted, and including, having his pick of law schools to attend. And so he was explaining to me how he ended up deciding to pursue academia. And the real reason is not what you might think. It's that this is super entrepreneurial business with a lot of choice, right? It's a lot of fun to do this work. You get to pick what you're working on. I mean, each of us are running like a small business, right? We're coming up with an idea, i.e. the future product. We're raising money to fund it. We're building a team of people with whom to work with. We're implementing, we're executing, and then we're out selling the product to policymakers and to other academics, And so and I until he said that, I didn't, and of course that gives us choice in where we live, choice in which hours we work, choice, we have some choice in what classes we teach, and choice in what conferences we can make and which ones we can't make it to. And so until he said that, I hadn't thought of that, because you might think academia is this stodgy thing that is you're doing the same job forever and you don't have a lot of, you're doing the very, you're punching a clock in some weird way, right? Which is totally the opposite of what it is. And that's what I would at that end, it's so important to try different things, right? So go out and get that business internship and that legal internship, or explore medicine or whatever it is, and see what fits you well, because it's not medicine for everybody.
Yeah, that's interesting. You always hear about how you can be really creative, or you just meet so many creative economists, but I hadn't heard it said that this is a job where you can be entrepreneurial, which is just another way of saying it. But that there's a lot more things that means than just being creative.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, and so and it's really when you look at it from 1,000 feet away, it really is a cool job in that way, you know.
Totally. Well, Bruce, thank you so much. It was to get to talk to you kind of scratched a lot of my lot of itches I have, and I had so many papers on this that I did want to talk to you about, which have always meant a lot to me, even your paper on colonialism and the wind, which you know, as prepping for this, I thought, I was going to ask you, I was going to say, I bet you're interested in boats. And then you sort of opened it up and said, I'm a
Oh yeah.
third generation boater.
Yes.
That was
And
such a
hopefully
great
trading
paper.
more. Yeah, thank you.
Well, it's wonderful. You've been such a pioneer, and honestly, I've looked up to your work for a long, long time, and it's really nice to meet.
Yeah, it's great. It's great seeing you again, Scott. What a lot of fun. I hadn't thought about this stuff in a long time, so it's nice to have this conversation and kind of put it in perspective.
Cool. Well, you have a great day. I'll hopefully we can cross paths on another sidewalk at another conference in the future.
Yes. That would be great. Awesome. Thanks for having me on the show,
All
Scott.
right. See ya.
All right, see you now. Bye.